But I thought that perhaps telling it a little bit in a chronology so that you could see the confusions that I was personally faced with and which I overcame, you know, were taught me things and maybe could tell you, you know, teach you things by telling you that story. Much of this work is based on collaboration that I've had now for the last 5 years or so with Roger Polk at our laboratory. He came into my office sometime 5 years, 6 years ago and started talking to me about what he might do in the lab in Josephson circuits, about which I knew nothing. I'd never worked, you know, I'm a solid state physicist more or less by background, but I'd never ever worked in superconductivity, let alone Josephson circuits. So he told me a whole lot of things that were immediately completely confusing to me. And it's been a long road, actually. There were quite a few years when there was rather, you know, small successes. Now we have, I think, considerable success. And actually, what I guess I'll get to near the end is that we've entered quantum optics, actually microwave quantum optics. So recently we had a department meeting, so, you know, 100 people in an auditorium at IBM, and the boss, one of the bosses, you know, got up and said, "Yeah, I have some neat data to show you." And he showed, you know, he got a movie going, which was a movie of some data of Roger's, which was a quantum oscillation. And he showed it as a time trace, and it was time, and there was something or other. I'll tell you about the something or other later. And he showed it as a little movie, which was just doing this. And then after a while, the movie you know, co-traveled with this curve. So you have to imagine. And he let it run for a while he was speaking. And it had gone through about 100 oscillations, and he said, "Well, but," and I won't cut it off now because it goes another 1,000 or more without considerable decay. So this was our, you know, our quantum oscillation of this superconducting qubit. But the secret was it wasn't at all an oscillation of the superconducting qubit. It was a quantum optics coherence, microwave quantum optics coherence. So, but there's quite a bit of story between here and there. So what Roger came into me with, well, not quite 5 years ago, because it went through several modifications, was a circuit, an electric circuit, which is sort of like this. I don't really do justice to it in the way that I draw it, but something like this. Whoops, supposed to be symmetric. See how I'm used to not having my PowerPoint.
I really see it as symmetric.
Okay. Yeah. If you look from the right, from over here, it looks very symmetric. So, and these are supposed to be these are electric wires, and somewhere in here, really invisible on the scale of an actual photograph that you would see of this thing, are things which I'll, you know, schematize as Josephson junctions. Of course, they're really just what this really is a piece of aluminum patterned into wires. And at special places there, the circuit is interrupted, and there's, you know, a bit of aluminum this way, and other aluminum evaporated over it that way, and with a very, very thin oxide in between. So there are three Josephson junctions, and it took me a long time to understand why this was a, you know, a conceivable qubit. But I'll tell you the way that I would explain it now, rather than giving you the year of confusion, is that now I understand that all qubits, or, well, not all qubits, all flux qubits, there are many, many things that you would call a flux qubit, and they all are based on this, the thing you've seen several times. Tony drew it in a somewhat more, you know, physically realistic way, you might say, indicating, yes, there's a loop of wire, and there's some barrier here. So the so-called RF squid. And so I'll do two things, or I'll indicate several things that are commonly done to this thing. Now, this already has, you know, notable quantum behavior. It's been understood since, I guess, the 70s. Certainly by the late 70s, it was understood that there was a, you know, this represented an interesting quantum mechanical object of its own. But one thing you do to make it a little more flexible is you take this single Josephson junction, you split it into two, only for the purpose of threading the hole with magnetic flux. So that's the tunable RF squid. And then you can, not entirely for aesthetic reasons, but not entirely not that either, kind of symmetrize it, that is, take the big outer loop and make it on the other side as well. So this makes this a gradiometer. What that means is that, this, I should say that this, of course, also has another, the thing, or this device already had something that you could do to it externally, which is apply a magnetic flux here. So to distinguish these two, I put a subscript here, just to follow our notation. There's a flux that controls the effective Josephson coupling here of these, and subscript C, and then there's sort of the main flux, phi. And by doing this gradiometric thing, you make the main flux gradiometric. That is, the whatever control you have here is affected by the difference of magnetic flux here and here. So it's a little easier to make sure that that doesn't occur for sort of unintended reasons. And then finally, for detailed reasons, you can throw other Josephson couplings in. So you interrupt this part of the circuit with the Josephson junction. And I'd say that changes details. It doesn't change anything very profoundly. And this is topologically the same as this. So I guess we're also, something needs topology here also. So there's some topology in this talk as well. So that's a rational way of arriving, well, rational by the way that other people think about it. Roger has entirely his own ways of thinking about it. So I wouldn't say this is the way he arrived at this. But I began to see, I've by now seen many, many more circuits like this, because you say, in one variant of this, there was this was coupled magnetically to a transmission line. I'll tell you more about that. And somewhere at the end of this transmission line was a SWID that was intended to measure this system magnetically. Nowadays, that part of the system is up here. So in other words, somewhere far away up here, there's another device that has Josephson junctions, and there are, as people have mentioned, there are capacitors here, put here and there to control something of the electronics, and they're thinking about or their thoughts about how you appropriately bring signals in from the outside world. So there's a part of the circuit which is a little current loop that is brought in order to affect this magnetic biasing. There's another current loop that that affects the biasing or produces a biasing on this small loop, et cetera. So there's a big catalog of electrical complexity. And at the same time, I was beginning to read papers, this was again 5 years ago or so, of Hans and of Gerd Schoen and others, and also being basically not initially understanding how you arrived at models for these things. So you would see a circuit of some kind, and then after a few lines, a Hamiltonian. Now, you can write this Hamiltonian at various levels, and I'll touch upon a few of these levels in this discussion. But perhaps I should review first, or I should mention a few of the basics of what is considered to be the essential physics of just the most important part of this, which is the Josephson junction, just by itself. And now I've mentioned that metallurgically it's two metals that are in very nearby contact, and of course you'll be told that the physics of this has to do with the fact that single electrons cannot tunnel through this, but nevertheless pairs of electrons in the superconducting condensate can tunnel. I don't actually need to invoke that physics, or I will in fact not invoke this physics in the discussion of this object.
Why have you discussed Josephson circuits without doing that?
Oh, because I put on my engineer's hat, you see. And an engineer, I'm supposed to be talking about engineers.
Still be there.
Well, we'll still be there, but there's this essential idea of the economy of description, which is a very important in engineering. We are constantly looking for simplified ways of describing things so that we can think bigger. And so you always have to be examining what you're doing to make sure you're not throwing away something. you know, I will, I, what I'm going to say is not of any news to you, but I want to emphasize that we do have a specific, a very particular level of description that we use for this basic element that makes the rest possible, or makes it possible to rationally think about the rest and design the rest. So there's something which is called the resistively shunted, junction model. It's called RSJ in the business. And again, it goes back 30, 40 years. Probably Tony knows a lot about the makings of this model. And it's based on, or it's summarized in a couple of equations. What you say is that that a practical Josephson junction actually consists of sort of a pure Josephson characteristic. I know this isn't so informative, because I'm about to say that a junction is equal to some ideal junction. So I'll say ideal. I have to define what an ideal junction is or what it consists of. But that it is shunted by a capacitor. It has a capacitive response. And then also, maybe, it has a resistance associated with it. Okay, so now it turns out this is indeed, the capacitance is indeed a crucial parameter. I'll mention, you know, a number just in case it's of interest to some people, that maybe 10 to 50 femtofarads is a kind of ballpark number. It's a smallish capacitance, but you know, it actually varies from one implementation to another. So this is not a sacred number, but there is a real genuine capacitance to these junctions, and it's a crucial parameter in the mechanical description, therefore the quantum mechanical description.
I just comment that I think you do have to be careful with using the smaller capacitance if you have a large ring, don't you? Because in that case, it will be shunted by the geometrical capacitance.
By a parasitic capacitance.
Yeah.
Yes. There is a thought. We spent months doing a model in which we included the parasitic capacitances, for example, here. And it seems that, I don't know what to say about this, that there are sort of positions in the circuit where capacitances are crucial, and there are places where they're not. So that indeed, even though, well, you know, even though in the next lab there's a 1 farad capacitor sitting on the shelf, you know, gigantic capacitance, it's not connected. That's not quite the case here. These are, of course, connected, and they're nearby, but they're not as crucial as the capacitance that directly shunts the junction itself. I don't know if that's helpful, but I think, you know, capacitances of this level are very meaningful, you know, are very crucial, in fact, in describing the dynamics of this this device. And then there is a resistance, the idea of this is that, well, we are told that, I think this is a result of miracles of processing, that one can really assume that resistance is infinity. You know, it could be there. I mean, there are contexts where it's important, but in the junctions that are used in these systems, you know, the material science has worked out that the effective resistance is really infinite. So I could really erase it for the purposes of this discussion.
Are you counting any resistance associated with the normal electrons in there?
Well, I suppose it does count that, yes.
So you have to be at
low temperatures, yes. I mean, there are many engineering aspects. It's easy for this to be false, indeed. So you have to be in the right, you know, right parameter range and low temperature in order for this to be true.
Yeah, but in this type of particular, it doesn't matter if you have 10 positive particles or not. I mean, that's negligible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Of course, in the charge qubit, it's supposed to get completely.
Mm-hmm. So the last thing I have to describe is what is an ideal Josephson junction. And it's described by, basically two equations, which were given to us by Josephson. They're Josephson's, I first write Josephson's second law, and they are both they're both kind of electrical engineering laws. That is, they're laws about the two-point response of this device, so the two-terminal response. So voltage as a function of time is equal to a fundamental constant, the flux quantum over 2 pi, times phi dot of t. Now, so phi is a new variable. It's not a current or a voltage, but it can be nevertheless viewed as it's a new kind of circuit variable like voltages and currents. I mean, in fact, you can consider this to be the defining equation for what a phase is, a Josephson phase. That is, it's just the time integral of the voltage, if you will. I mean, it has much deeper physical significance, and in fact, it is characterizes the phase of the superconducting condensate. You know, indeed, it relates back to the fundamental theory, and in fact, it is the difference of the phase of the superconducting condensate on two sides of the junction. So that's what it is microscopically. But to an electrical engineer, that's what it is. It's the thing that goes into this equation. The reason you need this equation is because complete characterization involves Josephson's first law, which is that the instantaneous current through this device is proportional to the sine of this phase. So you could say, well, I can eliminate phi from these two equations, and then I have just an equation relating current and voltage. So it's just a particular IV characteristic. To appreciate the nature of this IV characteristic, it's sometimes useful to imagine the situation where you can linearize this this first Josephson equation, the one I wrote second here, so that you note that current at time t is proportional to phi t if I do this linearization. And then if I take the first time derivative of this, so I dot of t is proportional to phi dot, and then is proportional to v via this equation. And that's to be compared with the equation of an inductor, which is indeed I dot of t is L inverse v of t. So that's why a Josephson junction is said to be an inductor. You know, that from the point of view of an electrical engineer, it is as an inductance behaves. It has the same IV, or the defining characteristic of an inductor is considered to be exactly this, that there's an instantaneous proportionality between the voltage across the device and the time derivative of the current. And that, I believe, it's not much deeper than that. That's why a Josephson element is often referred to it as an inductance. And in particular, you know, I don't have to do this linearization. And then you note that it's simply the case that I dot is a particular function, a particular nonlinear function, namely the inverse sine of the voltage at time t. And that also counts from an electrical engineer's point of view as the definition of an inductance. It's the definition of a nonlinear inductance. If this is never done, but you could in fact invent some other symbol, just to remind yourself of that, which would look something like this, an inductor, but with a nonlinear characteristic. But let me not confuse things. That's never used. So these are the basic equations of motion, and I spent quite some time understanding. Well, you have this, and you have a description of all the rest, and I want to give you a way that I currently understand, or the most compact way that I currently explain how you go from these thoughts to a Hamiltonian for the whole that will describe the whole system at some level, because after you've gotten to this Hamiltonian, you won't really be finished with describing all the things that can happen to this device. So I tried to convey here, maybe not so articulately, the fact that there's a great deal of potential complexity. You know, if you step further back from these systems, you see more and more stuff. You're told, oh, no, there's a capacitor there, and you back up further, and, oh, yes, in fact, there's a wire bond to here, and, oh, that off-chip thing has some you know, has some frequency dependent impedance. And, oh yes, there's a pulse generator out in the lab that's delivering energy, you know, delivering signals into this device. So I thought for a long time, and I'm still not really finished about, you know, what's the appropriate far backness that you should go to. But in fact, there's a point of view that deals with most of that kind of automatically, which merely arises from the observation that except for the Josephson junctions, everything outside transmission lines and coaxes and signal generators and capacitors and loops are, from an electrical point of view, linear. I mean, I'll never write another characteristic like this again. I mean, unless I get to a squid. But I may well choose, and in most cases I now do choose, to model that quantum mechanically as well. So here's a kind of general view that fits, I think, actually every Josephson device that's under study for qubits these days, which is that somewhere deep in the device, there are indeed some Josephson junctions. And then I kind of single them out by drawing little circles around them. And then there's a whole big world. And the main thing, or let's say the only thing I need to know about this world for the little derivation I'm about to give, is that the rest of this world is linear. In an electrical sense, that is, well, in a specific sense that I will state in a moment. So there's some number of Josephson junctions. I've shown three. I could show more. There's circuits where we care about five Josephson junctions. But I could, first off, I could write these equations with an index indicating what I'll call a port. In other words, here's port one, and here's port two, and here's port three. And so I'll call this a linear multiport. And now, well, many of you know that whenever you see linear, you should think linear response. You should think about constructing a Green's function. And in fact, that's the idea. To have a complete set of equations that describes everything, it suffices then to note that if you look outward from these ports and you say, well, for the purpose of this discussion, I erase this for a moment, and I say, suppose I have, I might say, a test voltage at this port. So there's V1, port 1. And I ask how much current does that produce across ports 2 and 3, or however many I have. And there's a linear response theory for that. So I sub I, let's say, the response, the current, at frequency omega, I'm going to be able to do things in the Fourier domain because this is all linear, is equal to or is proportional to the voltage at port J at frequency omega times some coefficient, and this is so Y for reactance, Y for J at frequency omega. And typically that would be the end of it, except that I'll just show you what we specialize this a little bit, noting the fact that the way we control these things is by magnetic fluxes. So this linear multiport may have some extra holes in it, which you thread with fluxes. So here's flux one, and there's another one here, flux two, et cetera. And these are worth singling out, well, because they often really can be viewed as fixed external control parameters. And also it's meaningful because this is a superconducting circuit, and this may well produce a persistent current. So there's a second term in this, because of this specialization, there's a second term in this linear response theory, Nik of omega, phi of omega, subscript k. So these the y and the n are just kind of Green's functions. Well, not just, they are formally Green's function coefficients. You know, they're a linear response description of this rest of the world. If you have a lump circuit description, you know, that is, you say this is an inductor and this is a capacitor and so forth, then there's a theory for, you know, there's a way of writing down these coefficient matrices in terms of the inductors and capacitors and how the circuit is wired up. They're actually quite complicated expressions. But if you just accept the fact that there is such a Green's function, which you can compute various ways, and which is not, by the way, confined to the idea that there are only lump circuit elements out here. There can be transmission lines and filters and impedances and all sorts of things. But the only way they affect the description of the system is by what you see looking out from these ports.
So David, you force V1, I2, and I3, this is an input in the problem.
Yeah, the right-hand side is input. This is the linear response to these inputs, the five and... Pardon me?
All three of them.
Three of which?
V1, I2, and I3. Is that... Do you fix I2 and I3?
No, you do not.
But then I don't understand why it's thinking, because there's some non-linearity in this.
Well, here's the non-linearity. It's what you connect to these ports. But
again, you pull the Joseph junctions out.
Correct.
What does that whole linear network do? He's calculating the response between all the Josephson junctions in the linear response way. So if I put a voltage on this Josephson junction, these are the induced currents I would get, perfect current.
Yeah. There's just a Kirchhoff law involved here. Here's the RSJ circuit. And what you say is, you know, the voltage, or there's a voltage instantaneously across this pair of terminals. And it produces a current, and the current is a sum of, the current through here, and the current through here, and the current through here, and that has to be equal to the current that flows back into these terminals via the, you know, the linear stuff. So that's why this completes, what you need to write the Kirchhoff equations for this.
I know you got it right. If you have a loop that contains a junction, if you take the junction, you don't have a loop anymore.
That's fine. You still have an inductance. You still have an inductance, and it may be coupled by a mutual inductance to another part of the circuit. Of course, you may say, well, the inductance is zero, and that's sort of a limiting case that you have to deal with separately, you know, by removing degrees of freedom. But yeah, there are cases that you would often consider the main cases that are at this level of treatment, the special cases. But they're not so hard to specialize to. So I thought I'd show, maybe I'd skip a couple of lines of algebra just to show you. If you combine these equations, and there's nothing very deep that's going to go on, I have to take another time derivative of this. So I'll get a phi double dot. I didn't write the equation, you know, the equation of the current of a capacitor. I won't write that at this point. But what you get is an equation like this. So after a few more lines, you get capacitance times, well, some phi naught over 2 pi. I'll keep them around for a while. Phi double dot of t plus IC sine phi I of t plus, now there's this RSJ term, this resistance. Well, I can leave it in. I'll leave it in for a moment. But as I said, we're accustomed to dropping it, phi 0 over 2 pi r phi dot. So it's just friction. I'm getting ahead of myself. And then equals, so I organize this thing so that The rest of the right-hand side of this equation is this multi-port response. Now, I have to multiply by some omegas and things, but so what you end up getting is something like this. You get actually an integral equation. So this, in general, depends on time phi's at some earlier time, t prime. And there's some kernel here, which I give a different symbol to, t minus t prime. And I need indices here now, sorry, phi sub i, and then this is mij, phi j. So the Josephson junction see other Josephson junctions via this linear response. And m is a close relative of y. It just has an extra time derivative or, you know, factor of omega thrown in. And then there's another term for the for these external fluxes. Now I've gone through this little bit of discussion to bring out a few things. So this is not at a Hamiltonian yet, but I'm at an equation of motion that I can recognize, or in special cases I can instantly recognize. It's isomorphic to the equations of a massive particle. You know, here's the ma term in Newton's equation, so the acceleration terms times something that plays the role of a mass. So I should put a subscript c sub I here because the capacitance may be different for different Josephson junctions. And it has various, or it's subjected to various forces. And one force term is just this Josephson term. Here's a viscous force. And then there are these things, which are some kind of time retarded forces. Now, yeah?
This equation should be supplemented with the fact that when you go through some of the changes, should be defined.
Yes, that should be considered correct. Now, for these equations, it's built into the initial. If you think of these differential equations, it's part of the initial conditions. Correct. So you don't see it at the differential equation level.
So it's a constraint.
Pardon me?
It's a constraint.
Yes, yeah. Or it constrains the legal initial conditions, I guess I would say.
You also include capacitances that are not junctions.
Well, okay. I'm getting to that actually, because now the rest of the physics is discussions mainly of this. This is no big deal. I'm not going to do any specialization of this term because this just says that the flux at time t prime affects the circuit sometime later. There's some retardation of the response to an external variation of flux. So. It actually doesn't, nothing special about the structure of this need be brought in. But this term is important. You know, this is part of the dynamics. That is, it's like a potential. So this is just a fixed inhomogeneous term in this equation. But this is, this really is part of the dynamics. It's a retarded term. So here are a few specializations that are important. If the linear multiport, the linear part of the circuit, is purely inductive, in other words, if I can really view it as lumped inductances, Roger came into me and said, well, the inductance of this is such and such many nanohenries, and it has a certain mutual inductance to something or other. And if that's all that's in the problem, then this M is instantaneous. So it actually is a delta response. And this term is an instantaneous response. This becomes an ordinary differential equation. And if I can erase this, then I recognize this as a conservative, as the equation for a conservative system. Just the motion of a massive particle in a potential. In other words, I can integrate this and deduce a potential from this. This, if I integrate this, this becomes a quadratic potential. and this sine turns into a cosine. So you get, I mean, all the way back to this, you know, it is conventional to say that the description of this is that it's like a massive particle rolling in a potential which has a form like this, that it has a sinusoidal or cosine dependence, and then superimposed on it is a parabolic dependence that depends inversely on the inductance of the loop. So you have several minima, and then the capacitance tells you the mass, and therefore, well, this leads you both to a Hamiltonian. That is, I have usual kinetic plus potential energy, where the potential energy is defined by all this in this special limit. And the kinetic energy is just the usual p squared over m, where m is this mass, is this effective mass. And that's all. Well, that's not all. But that's where we get to so far. But that takes you a long way. And I will tell you some things about the qubit based on that. But I should say a few more things about I mean, there's much more to discuss at this model level and where you have to go depending on what's happening. Now, of course, first of all, the circuit is never purely inductive. As I said, you know, the engineer will also tell you, okay, the capacitance here is such and such. And then that will make this response truly retarded, and you have to do something new about that. And then it depends. Then there are a few possibilities of what you would do, which basically depend on where the poles of this response sit in frequency. Because once you have circuits with inductors and capacitors, then you have poles, you have resonances in the response. And they may be, I should just randomly use a color here. These poles of y of omega and therefore of m of omega may sit at frequencies very high compared with the qubit frequency. And if they're high enough, then you just ignore them, ignore the capacitance. If they're not too high, then you can wrap this together with something else that I'll describe in a moment. But you may have the circumstance where the poles of this are very close, or basically right on top of the frequencies of interest. And then then it's essential that you don't ignore these extra capacitances. And a prescription, which has been quite useful, is in that case to find those capacitances, make new ports in this multiport, and just locate the capacitances and put them in. So add ports as necessary to describe the extra poles that are present in the response, so that whatever remains is mostly inductive. You cannot.
There are modes that go all over the surface.
Well, you can take a phenomenological approach. That is, if you...
But that is a combination of the real capacities.
Well, you can either go about the business of finding the actual physical capacitances and saying those are the capacitances that I single out in the dynamics, which means I have a new equation where I have more indices and I have new terms like this. I have new phases. In fact, I get a new dynamical variable, which is the phase across the capacitor, the time integral of the voltage across the capacitor. As I say, you may approach it by finding the actual physical inductances and putting them in, but actually all you're obliged to do is find a way of putting these into the multiport such that you reproduce this reactance. And that's all, that's enough, even if it doesn't correspond to the physical capacitance. And that's precisely what we do for transmission lines, because transmission lines have a distributed capacitance. And so there isn't a convenient physical model of the actual capacitance, but you can, if you only care about, you know, the first or maybe the first and the second pole due to the transmission line, then you can put in, you can make a one pole approximation, put in an effective capacitor, and then the rest of the response will indeed be mostly inductive up to the frequency near the next resonance. So as I said, I'm kind of an engineer here. There are times when I don't care about the microscopics, even microscopics defined by, you know, physical circuits. So that's been, this is the toolkit that we use to build Hamiltonians. I would goes so far as to say that's the toolkit that everybody has used to build Hamiltonians, except they don't usually describe it in the way that I've just said, not quite in so general and grand a way. But I mean, we've been in the business of studying the Hamiltonian in many variants of this thing, so it was not suitable to just sort of think through by hand how you get to a good Hamiltonian in every case.
David, I just wanted to add one comment. When you read our papers, we usually have a very simplified picture of the circuit, but you know, that's to make the paper clear.
Yeah.
But in the back of our mind, we're thinking about all this stuff. Yeah, and all the resonances and stuff, and we design the circuit so that stuff doesn't matter.
Well, of course, you want to push them away.
Just in the back of our minds, we have to take everything.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Well, I'd say that, 5 years ago, I was not so smart. Now I'm extremely smart. But I wasn't so, I just wasn't very smart.
We made our mistakes too, yeah.
Yeah, but actually it was a fortunate thing to make some mistakes at the outset, because we had some capacitors that weren't actually thought through and were there,
right,
and they turned out to be really terrific. Because, well, as usual, okay, you know, when you put somebody like me up on a soapbox, there's no limit to how long I could talk, but I'll try to keep it to the hour. So it turned out, oh, well, here I have my picture of my transmission line. Now, transmission line is a complex object, and it happened that what was used in this experiment was, with 3 years ago, was a relatively low loss transmission line. That is really just a loop of superconductor, and then connected to it somewhere else, or somewhere a little further downstream, was a measurement device, which did have dissipation and so forth. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't say one thing that was important. That I've only talked about the reactive part of M of omega, Y of omega, that is, it has capacitance and inductance. What about the resistances? Because indeed, if you look far enough out, if you, you know, do your demagnification far enough, you see real resistors in the circuit. They're just, they're arranged not to be so close. And, you know, that means that this Y will have a real and imaginary part. And in general, what you do is you do as well as you can using these tricks. You know, you find the inductive part, or you throw in some capacitors so that you've gotten the rest of the reactants, the non-dissipative part of the reactants to be inductive. But then there's still a real part, and that we deal with using, quote, Caldera Leggett. And Tony told me he had to leave, so I can use his name now. That is, there's a standard method of introducing a bath of oscillators that will describe the remainder. So the remainder of this, the real part or imaginary part, I always forget, once I throw in eyes here and there, will actually represent the spectral density of a set of oscillators. So that's the spin boson part of this model, that ultimately that is the way that we chose to describe this whole system. And it gives you some handle, finally, on not only the quantum dynamics of the system, but also its losses and decoherence. Some handle, a very tenuous handle, it seems, finally. But let me describe sort of the successes of the model, you know, this kind of model regime applied to this qubit. So it has three Josephson junctions, so it's equivalent to a particle rolling around in a three-dimensional potential. Now, and what the circuit people could tell me fairly precisely was, you know, the lumped circuit behavior of this. So in other words, they were telling me in some coded language the reactance of the whole rest. So we turn the crank, whoops, we get a three-dimensional potential, which first off has one direction that we don't care about because it corresponds to, there's a direction where the potential is very steeply rising, and it's because the inductance of this is very small. There's an inverse relation between sizes of inductances and the stiffness of these harmonic parts of the potential. So there's one direction that doesn't matter, because then you would usually say that's because there's a constraint on the phases as you go around. Just the phase of this plus the phase of that has to equal some multiple of 2 pi because you neglect the inductance of this. So that part of the potential is uninteresting. And so there are two dimensions left, and there's plenty of interesting dynamics in that direction. And it depends a lot on the state of these two fluxes, the phi, I'll draw here, this flux, and then the flux that controls this small loop. So you can find regimes of that parameter space where, and I'm going to sort of sketch contour plots, so you find a minimum of potential somewhere. This is a highly nonlinear potential, though, and so there's a minimum here. And then you find a replica of this over here. And everywhere else, the potential is rather high. So this is one instance of what goes on. And in fact, this repeats periodically in this direction. And that's because there's a symmetry to the problem that there's a central phase, that is, there's a part of this circuit here that is only connected to the rest of the world by Josephson junctions. And so if you advance the phase of that island by 2 pi or 4 pi, it makes no physical difference. And so therefore, the potential is periodic in that direction. But there's plenty of structure inside the unit cell. So you you find regimes where there's a two well-separated minima that correspond to circulating currents. In the original SWID, that means currents this way and that way. And in this gradiometric system, it corresponds to currents that flow sort of in this pattern or in the reverse pattern. And there are regimes of parameters where these are very well separated, and in fact, where the system is, it's so well separated with such a gigantic barrier in between that the system is hysteretic. It's actually a permanent magnet. And in there are many characterizing, you know, experiments that these devices are subjected to. So if you measure the magnetic hysteresis as a function of these parameters, this flux and the control flux, you see a feature which sort of looks like this. A strange looking thing, which we always call the fluke, some kind of you know, little animal, if I put some eyes on it or something. But in fact, it matches perfectly the theory. So it says that, yes, indeed, you know, we're definitely on the right track. This is where you go through, you sweep back and forth, and you see where the system is hysteretic. And it's hysteretic in a little band like this. And it corresponds very precisely to where we expect there to be a regime where there's a double well with a very big barrier. This little point here of this fluke corresponds to an interesting sort of geometrical change that there's in one part of this parameter space, these two minima are nearest together. And then as you change the parameters, this one sort of evolves over so that at some point it's the distance from here to here that becomes the lesser. So and the point where it crosses from one to the other is the point of widest hysteresis loop. So that, you know, it's that kind of thing that tells us this Hamiltonian is doing a very good job. Now, that's just the classical physics of that. And the Hamiltonian, of course, is, well, it's a classical object. It describes the mechanical or the dynamical behavior of this as a classical object in the classical regime, and hopefully as a quantum object when you know, the scale of action becomes comparable to H bar. And so, in fact, the interesting regime.
David.
Yes.
So, what's that regime exactly in terms of resistance and, you know, retardation? So you're putting
in terms of what? I'm sorry.
R, the resistance. I mean, so you're putting R infinity.
Yes. Well, the theory that I'm describing, well, it doesn't matter much for this particular phenomenon. But yes, the junction resistance to infinity.
It's infinity and then retardation. There is retardation.
And the what?
Retardation.
Retardation. Well, for this too, it turns out that, although it's not obvious, that it's all the qualitative behavior is accounted for acceptably by just including the capacitances of these junctions alone, and everything else is inductors. So it is indeed, it's the benign situation. So no retardation. It's the benignest situation, which we know is false in detail, but it certainly captures all this. Now, as I said, we went to the trouble of including a model with several stray capacitances, you know, parasitic capacitances that are numerically as big as the junction capacitances, and they just seem to renormalize the theory in uninteresting ways. I mean, they make the particle dynamics higher dimensional, but those other dimensions don't do anything interesting. I mean, you can still find a double well structure, and the barriers are modified a little bit, so this whole picture is shifted a bit, but doesn't change very much. So it turns out the interesting regime is up here, where you see no hysteresis. And of course, that is to say it's the regime where these, or it is, in fact, the regime where these two wells start to get close together. And so there's a regime where, if you go high enough here, these two wells merge, in fact. So you have something which is at least a kind of two-dimensional version of the ideal or one ideal setting for talking about quantum behavior of qubits, which is a double well potential. So along this line, you get a very tunable double well potential. That is, there is a parameter which turns out to be this one, the flux through the large loop that controls the asymmetry of this double well. And the other parameter, this one, this phi sub c, is the thing that controls the height of the barrier all the way from macroscopically big, you know, Schrodinger cat kind of magnitude to zero, to nothing. And so you can hope already to do interesting experiments. And, you know, we were immediately trying, or Roger was immediately trying Nakamura-style experiments. Let's see. In which, in this double well language, in which you start the system in this very classical regime. See, we thought that this classical regime would be of great advantage in that the system would be very easy to set in its initial state, and it's very easy to read out. And those turn out to be true, that in those two respects, this is not a problematic qubit at all. So you set the system in the left state. Say you do it, well, you do it in a few steps. You do indeed, take the system so that it falls into the left state, and you raise the well, the depth of the well, so that it's not very asymmetric. And then you fairly rapidly lower the barrier. I'm sorry, I could do this all color-coded, but you lower the barrier so that, in fact, the eigenstates of the system, the energy eigenstates are, the lowest is the symmetric state, symmetric double well state, and the other state is an anti-symmetric combination. Well, I can say that, or I can also just say that what you look for then is tunneling dynamics. You've got the system where there's, it's here and it's almost symmetric, so it has, so its time dynamics is the particle will tunnel to the other side. But this is coherent, so it'll tunnel right back again. So it'll execute Larmor oscillations in this double well. And then after a certain length of time, you bring it back to this classical regime. You raise the barrier very high, and then you measure. And that gave reasonably good Larmor oscillations. And Roger has recently gotten quite a bit better at that. And so you see something like this. But unfortunately, the coherence times have never been that good, maybe 10 nanoseconds. But you do see a behavior exactly as you expect. That is, the period of these oscillations is very sensitive, unfortunately, very, very sensitive to the final height of the barrier that you come to. So as you lower the barrier more and more, it becomes more and more transparent, and the tunneling frequency goes up higher and higher. That's one reason why we've always felt that this is not a good candidate for a qubit by itself, because if you look at the energy diagram, so you have a ground state which falls zero. This is mainly as a function of this control flux. And you have something where the splitting is essentially zero until you get to some threshold, quasi-threshold, and then it takes off very rapidly. So the energy splitting, which is the thing you see, or the period of which is what you see as the Larmor oscillation, is quite unstable. I mean, the system had to be engineered very carefully to avoid one of ref noise and things like that. And still, the coherence has never been seen to be very good. Okay, but I began to mention at some point that, well, there was this transmission line here. And, actually, it has a resonant frequency of a couple of gigahertz, which is right in the regime of interest. That is, if you do the model of this curve, it passes well above 2 gigahertz. I mean, the experimental oscillations that are seen are all the way up to about 10 gigahertz. So it means we have a degree of freedom somewhere here at a couple of gigahertz that was in the initial model grossly, ignored. But you can remedy that if you only want to model the lowest mode of this transmission line. You just need literally just one LC circuit with the right parameters, and you accurately match the impedance as seen outward from the junctions, at least for the fundamental mode. So you throw that into the model. So it's one extra harmonic oscillator. And so if there were no coupling, in other words, no mutual inductance between this new circuit and the rest, then the energy diagram would consist of this along with levels, you know, one photon, two photon, three photon levels of the harmonic oscillator. Well, you'd also see replicas. You'd see photon replicas of the original band picture. So you'd see one photon plus an excitation of the qubit, and two photons plus an excitation of the qubit, and so forth. Now, there is a mutual inductance between these. In the initial experiment, it wasn't very big. But in some of the experiments, there was a sign of an oscillation that really corresponded to this frequency. And so it became evident that it was a good thing to increase the coupling, which opens a gap here. I'll say 2G. That just helps people who think James Cummings model, because this is a band picture of a James Cummings diagram, James Cummings model, basically, as a function of the splitting of the two-level system. And then, with a little more work, it was clear that if you pass through this, you know, you're pulsing this phi sub c, and you were, in the original idea, you were just going up this curve. But if you go slow enough with respect to the size of this gap, and this was sort of gigahertz scale, so it didn't have to be very, very slow, you would pass on to this branch of the curve, so that instead of having a superposition of the eigenstates of the qubit, the symmetric and anti-symmetric states of the qubit, you would pass on to the vacuum and one photon state of the resonator. So, and that's when the oscillation, then that's when he got the oscillation that our boss showed proudly, Uber boss showed proudly in our meetings, that went on for thousands of oscillations. So it's sort of a cheat in the sense that, well, you say, well, no, it's not a Josephson qubit at all. It's just a resonator qubit. But it's quantum. In this ideal description, it is really a very quantum state of this oscillator. It's just a superposition of the zero and one photon state. And it passes reasonable number of tests for its quantumness. And it's very coherent, because the transmission line is very coherent. In the meantime, the transmission line was purpose designed to behave in the right way and be very low loss itself. So it has a coherence time observed. Well, it's annoying to me that they saw oscillations out to 2 microseconds. They said, oh, it didn't decay very much. So, well, what's the decay time? I said, we haven't gotten around to measuring it, measuring other things. Well, you know, how big do you think it is? That's probably more than 10. Well, you got to find out. And, well, they haven't so far. But for them, a few thousand oscillations was enough. Now, there's a whole story, which is really a whole other talk, of what you can do with this. Because we haven't got, we'd like to have quantum gates and all of the things that we've talked about before. I'll throw in one equation that what we've got. Hans gave a talk earlier in which he wrote down the model, which is indeed the applicable model here that you have, or it's part of the applicable model. You have, except I don't remember, I guess we'll say sigma x here, plus epsilon sigma z. What we get compared with Hans's model, he emphasized that this parameter is a function of an externally controllable parameter. Now we've got 2 parameters, and roughly speaking, the second one controls delta. So we have more control than his model. Now you can make a 2-qubit circuit out of this by just having a mutual inductance between 2 identical devices. And you will indeed get, I won't write the other 1-qubit terms, but you'll get something that's sigma z1 times sigma z2, and you'll get a j. And that j is also tunable. And it's really mainly tunable because of the presence of the transmission line, that when you've passed, when you, as we say, parked, the qubit, made it an optical qubit, then it it doesn't see the neighboring qubit. It's that is, if this structure is coupled to a similar one next to it and it has a transmission line connected to it, then it's only a very, very high order process that couples these qubits. So this J can be made very small.
David, this is, this is an on and off resonance phenomenon. You're not changing the coupling.
No, it's really a change. Well, at what level? You know, at the level of electrical engineering, you're not changing the coupling. There is a mutual inductance. It is what it is. So our circuit Hamiltonian has no, you know, nothing tunable. But once you look at the behavior of the lowest two levels of each system, then it is very tunable because of this feature that once you've passed the system onto this optical branch, it has hardly any matrix element for coupling because, well, basically because the coupling comes from having this circulating current around this loop. And one of the things you've done by passing the system onto this quantum optics branch is that there's no circulating current anymore. The qubit's all down on the resonator. It has very, very little content on the qubit. And so there's nothing to couple magnetically to the neighboring structure. So we get good contrast here. What I've left out in this are the four control fluxes, and it depends mostly on just two of them. It mostly just depends on whether you parked or not. And we've worked out quantum gates on paper for doing this that all seem to get to about 99% fidelity, based on a noise model which I have hardly touched upon. The resistors are part of them, but it's only a part of it. The main part of the noise model, in fact, is one of ref noise from a variety of sources. Now that's on paper. In real life, there are still problems that we do not have a diagnosis for, mainly that while the relaxation times are very nice, they're very nice up here, very satisfactory for everything. But to do quantum gates, you have to take excursions into this nonlinear regime. And there the relaxation times, even including T1, become unexplainably crummy. That is, very quickly they go down to the 10 nanosecond regime. And we don't understand that. They shouldn't get so small, especially the T1s. So there's still a real fundamental mystery about these qubits, about why, in certain respects, they behave very badly. So,
about this fidelity, these are calculated including also higher dimensions?
Yes, so that's also including leakage effects. So we do models that contain these levels and several higher ones, and then do standard time-dependent Schrodinger equation and look at Landau-Zener tunneling and all of those sort of things. And we've tried to do, you know, as good a job as we can. I mean, pretty thoroughly modeling the system and what we know about it. Yes. Yes, we put it. Oh yes, absolutely. Yes, we assumed that we would have flux one of ref noise at the scale of 10 microfinot per root hertz at 1 hertz, which is, you know, a number that's usually achieved. And we assume that for both, you know, both fluxes were subjected, or all four, say, in the two qubit models, were all subjected to that amount of one of ref noise. There's some inconsistency to how we treat noise, in that at low frequency we say one of ref, and that's just a classical model of noise. And then at high frequency we have formulas for T1 and T2, which are just golden rule formulas that come from, quantum analysis of high frequency noise, and we don't have a good way of matching the two. We're engineers, you know. So I'm sorry, I just barely managed to fit my discussion into 1 hour. I mean, it was a real effort. I have to really cover my mouth a little bit more. Well, I wasn't supposed to talk till 7. God forbid. Was there a schedule? I don't know. I knew I was starting at 5, but otherwise I knew nothing. Well, are there any more questions or comments or whatever?
Can you say something about the measurement?
Oh, yeah. Well,
what is the
on good day, 95%. At the moment, it's just the ramp-up method. As Roger and other people in the team, have evaluated the various other methods that are around and have not seen, you know, a big enough advantage in this system to going to resonant readout or bifurcation readout to make it worth it. And they also see a growth of complexity of this sort of mid-scale real estate, you know, of all the stuff, you know, the electrical things that are not so far from the qubit that have to be present. So, you know, the big advantage is that, Tony, or you mentioned, and Tony latched onto the thing that, oh, this is only, you know, 10 to the minus 3 of a flux quantum. But if you go deep into this hysteretic regime, it's a good fraction of a flux quantum worth of signal.
Large loops.
Because, yeah, they're large loops. They're easy to read out. I think that was the big gamble of Roger's, to say that, can we still expect decent quantum behavior if you make inductances electromagnetically rather than using Josephson inductances? And I think the jury is still out, because this 10 nanoseconds is not acceptable. And it's, I can say, well, there are other places on this characteristic where that time is much better. But we do care about this is happening at a point in parameter space we care about, actually. And the big loops may be biting us, but they do make readout very easy. Well, very. I mean, Roger has never complained about that being a real difficulty. Now, he is worried about back action effects. I mean, squid, so it's an unshunted squid, but it's noisy. I mean, the states of the squid itself are very short lifetime, the way that it's done. And they're thinking about, well, maybe there's more filtering that needs to be done, or filtering done better to make the squid lifetime better, because that's possibly polluting this somewhat, although theory doesn't indicate that it should. But to summarize again, it's just a DC squid. You ramp up and measure its critical current. And it can be made essentially single shot. That this was part of the trade-off of whether you couple it strongly enough that it is really genuinely single shot, that the two distributions are really separated, or whether you live with, you decouple a little bit, try to get the back action smaller, and then live with a lower fidelity readout on a single ramp up. But actually, since this qubit can be held, you know, down here it stays stable for seconds, so you could ramp up many times and make it effectively single shot anyway. It would make the measurement long. Sorry, I guess I should have said it's very technical. Yes, Alexander.
If you have two qubits and you use this type of readout, do you think readout of the first qubit will affect the second, or you can eye the second as a full term?
We have concepts of, you know, long-term parking. So you can actually push up far enough on this characteristic that you can do basically anything you want to the other qubit. I mean, that I should perhaps emphasize that that's a key thing that we've always been worried about crosstalk, and it's quite legitimate to worry about. You know, you have a control here, well, 10% of it leaks over here easily, and that's still true. But in this system, because of this parking, you can basically render a qubit invisible. So you can, in fact, have a lot of electromagnetic signals present that really don't affect it at all.
And are you sure about that?
No. But I mean, I'd say this measurement of long coherence time was a good sign.
Because you have strong junction, right? Pretty strong junction. And if that is stretching to the voltage, it's generating 100 GHz into this. There's a large amplitude. So did you analyze
that? No, and I see your point, because the kind of experiments that have been done wouldn't be so sensitive to that.
In
that
they're,
at the moment, they're just sort of single shot experiments that is used. So, point taken. I don't know, 100 gigahertz, is that really true? Okay,
yeah.
Josephson radiation.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's the radio strength.
Okay, fair enough. I don't think that's really been probed. I'll carry that question back. Maybe that'll keep them busy for half a year.
One small comment. So you said that you couldn't resolve, measure the coherence time of the photon, basically. But if you, I guess if you just look at the line, you'll have that without any time measure.
Well, this is a weird system. Up until recently, there have been no microwaves in and out, in or out of this system. So there's no spectroscopy. The only spectroscopy is what you can do with your pulses. Okay. And that's been another decision that's probably been costly in total. It does mean that you can contemplate running this system, even a 6 gigahertz qubit or 8 gigahertz qubit, with an electrical bandwidth that's, say, 800 megahertz. So you never have to introduce radiation at the resonant frequency, nor extract it. And there may ultimately be real advantages to that. It certainly drives the filter design, in quite a detailed way. You really take advantage of that.
So right now you're talking about 1 qubit or 2 qubits. Would it be possible to create a two-dimensional array of such qubits, including measurement device for each of them? And if so, what would be the qubit separation, and could you couple qubits for that distance?
Yeah, I understand all your questions about that. That's where, if I had my PowerPoint, I could answer that, because that's certainly been, I'll say, dreamt through for these qubits. The physical scale is pretty large. I think the qubit-qubit distance on a square array could be imagined to be 100 microns or something like that, but not smaller with this kind of qubit. The contemplated solution to how you get all the signals in and out is by so-called three-dimensional integration, which is a big project in our lab. So you bring wires out this way. So people are thinking about how to do that, how you do it, how you do it in this system is a whole question. But that's the plan of record anyway, as we say. But that's so far in the future that, it's just a dream at the moment.
And the couple, you could couple for that distance with these 100 microns, 2 qubits?
Oh, well, the hard part is to make it to make the distances any smaller, actually, because the qubit itself, I mean, I didn't give you a scale, but this is already, I don't know what the number is, 30, 50 microns. It's a gigantic thing as an electric circuit.
That makes coupling much stronger.
It's easy to make strong coupling, actually. We've been trying out various kinds of gates, and for some of them, we want mutual inductances that are smaller than what they sort of imagine having in the lab.
Okay.